Okay, so I think we can go ahead and get started with the program this afternoon. It's an honor to have Minister Rob Renner of the Minister for Environment in the Province of Alberta with us today. He's here in town, I think, to try to put this case forward for the efforts that Alberta is making in watching over the development of resources in that province. The importance of Alberta is probably well, and Alberta and Canada to U.S. energy security is probably well known to this group, but I've been following the numbers for quite a while. By the way, I'm David Pumphrey. I'm the Deputy Director of the Energy and National Security Program. Sorry, I should have jumped into that in the beginning. But we're importing about 2.5 million barrels per day from Canada now, which is a number that has been rising importantly over the past few years, and a lot of that is directly attributed to the growth of oil sands production in Alberta. If you look at conventional oil production in Canada, it, like the you see in the U.S. in terms of conventional production, has been in the decline. So this role for Canada to play in our energy security has been growing through the development of these very important resources. But with that development, of course, have come a lot of questions about the environmental effects of the development, both the land and water effects as well as the climate change effects. And we thought it would be very good to have Minister Renner have a chance here to come and really lay out the steps that Alberta is taking to manage these environmental impacts and look towards the future and provide a clean source of energy, clean and secure source of energy for the future. We've passed out a bio for the minister. He's been, I guess your first election was in 1993. So you've been in the political life for quite a number of years now. Been Minister of Municipal Affairs as well as in your second term as Minister of the Environment. So without any further ado, I'd like to welcome Minister Renner to give his remarks, and then we'll have some time for questions.
Thanks, Kevin.
Well, thanks very much, David. It's a real pleasure for me to be here. We were thinking back last night. I think this is only the second time that I've been able to come to D.C. and it's a dynamic place to be. It's an exciting place to be, and I hope that I tune up the frequency a little bit more because I'm very, very pleased to be here. And I'm very, very pleased that organizations like yours, David, help us to facilitate, bring together a group of people, which that then brings me to all of you. I want to thank you. I know that everyone in this room is busy. Everyone in this room has other places that they could be. And I'm very, very pleased and honored that you felt that you could take some time out of your lives to spend a little bit of time with me. I'm going to try and keep my comments to about 20 minutes or thereabouts, and so if as I am speaking, you have something that gets jogged in your mind, write it down, and we'll try and get through as many questions as we possibly can before I have to head off to my next meeting. Well, as you might imagine, I'm quite proud of Alberta, the extraordinary Western Canadian province that I call home. For those of you who are not yet familiar with Alberta, and I encourage each and every one of you to pay us a visit, it's no exaggeration when I tell you that we have been blessed with a land rich in natural and beauty and natural resources. We enjoy some of the continent's most beautiful national parks, unique badlands, soil-rich prairies, and expansive forests. And we have a population of open, creative, and dynamic people in Alberta. It's an interesting and powerful combination, and as a result, we have a great story to tell, and I'm delighted to be here to share a part of that story with you today. Specifically, I would like to share how we are balancing our role as a global energy leader with our commitment to be an environmental leader. So let's start with energy. After all, laying claim to the second largest oil reserve in the world is not insignificant, particularly in a world where energy demand is expected to grow by 45% in the next 20 years, according to the International Energy Agency. But I'll have you note, I didn't claim that we are an oil leader. I called us an energy leader. We know that we need to invest time, money, and effort into next-generation energy sources like wind and solar. And we have, and we will continue to do so. As part of Alberta's comprehensive energy strategy, renewable sources of energy are an increasingly important part of Alberta's energy portfolio. In fact, we've invested $239 million in a bioenergy program which continues to provide grants that promote cleaner transportation fuels and electricity. This funding has already leveraged $850 million in additional private sector investment in renewable energy. And we have significant wind capacity. As a government, we ensure that at least 90% of the power that fuels our buildings comes from green sources. But we know that regardless of how much effort we put into breaking our collective addiction to oil, fossil fuels will continue to account for the majority of the world's primary energy mix for the next several decades. As an energy leader, Alberta can play a key role in meeting this demand, now and for the foreseeable future. All the while continuing our efforts to develop greener energy sources. Now, I know many of you will likely have heard about our oil sands, and some of you may have heard some things that are not particularly flattering about them. So let's talk about oil sands. Well, Alberta has a long history in conventional oil and natural gas. We are investing in renewable energy, and it's in the oil sands that set us apart from other energy producers around the world. And for many, the oil sands have put Alberta on the map. Alberta's oil sands contain 173 billion, that's billion with a B, barrels of oil that is economically recoverable with today's technology. Put another way, Alberta's oil sands are capable of sustaining production of 3 million barrels a day for the next 150 years. Production today is less than half of that, around 1.3 million barrels a day, meaning that Alberta can increase production and deliver it at a time when many other U.S. foreign suppliers simply cannot. Quite simply, the oil sands are a critical strategic resource for the ailing economy, domestically and beyond our borders. It means that the oil sands will play a significant role in both meeting the world's energy demands and pulling us out of the collective economic crisis that we face. But as always, it's about more than just economics. Our focus on responsible oil sands development includes addressing the economic, environmental, and social issues that surround the development. In my role as an environment minister, my attention is often focused by the lens of my portfolio. Albertans have seen industry make technological advances on the production side to reduce emissions and lessen the environmental footprint. But we know much more can be done to make extraction of our natural resources more environmentally sound. And we believe this can be achieved without sacrificing jobs or the economy. In fact, even in this economic downturn, the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers is forecasting that $16 billion will be invested in the oil sands in the upcoming year 2009. That's a huge investment. It spurs economic growth and jobs in Alberta, across Canada, and indeed even here in the U.S. With 44% of oil sands-related employment outside of Alberta, the decisions that we make don't just affect Albertans. It's a fact. Every drop of oil comes with some environmental risk. And quite frankly, our province is the largest emitter of greenhouse gases in Canada. We know we have a huge challenge ahead of us, and we know we need to do a better job. But I can tell you that Albertans are as fiercely passionate as anyone about environmental protection and preservation. We know Alberta energy must be developed as cleanly as possible, using the best technologies available. And Albertans expect this, and so do our customers. We need to find the balance, between what is right for the environment and what is right for the economy. We know we've got high expectations to live up to, and I'm confident that we can meet those expectations. Alberta's success has always come from the pursuit of what's possible. That's why I'm confident in Alberta's future, Canada's future, and our collective future as North Americans. In our shared challenges, we find collective opportunities. Canada and the U.S. have long been great neighbors. There's never been a better time for neighbors to get to know each other better, to understand how we can help each other. Beyond mere geographic proximity, the strength of our shared commerce and culture has forged diverse links between our countries, the provinces, and the states within them. It's time to open doors to good ideas and friends that share our spirit to achieve. North America will need secure and affordable energy. There can be no sustained economic recovery without it. But I'm also convinced that concerns about climate change, pollution, water shortages, human health, and industrial footprint are now solidly entrenched in the hearts and minds of every one of us, regardless of the state of the economy. And that's why I'm so pleased that our two great nations are working together to make sure that while we rebuild our economies, we keep our eyes clearly focused on the challenges, of other challenges, and one of those is climate change. Now's the time for leadership in these areas, not only as we build our plans to work within North America, but also as we proceed towards international talks in Copenhagen later this year. Alberta is committed to playing a role in global solutions. I find it somewhat ironic that speculation persists that as a nation, Canada will be looking for some sort of free pass for the oil sands in our international negotiations. Let me be perfectly clear. We're not asking for a free pass. The oil sands do not receive a free pass in our own regulatory system, and we certainly wouldn't expect one in another system elsewhere. What we do want is a common North American system that respects jurisdictional differences and appreciates local efforts that are underway. A system that works for one place does not necessarily work in another. A planning system that works for California would not necessarily work in Oregon, despite their proximity. Each province and state has its own challenges and its own means to find solutions. Everyone has their own experience and expertise to bring to the table. But we can work together toward the same goal, real, lasting emission reductions. So let me tell you just a little bit about what we're doing in Alberta about climate change. We introduced comprehensive new strategy just over a year ago, a strategy that builds on what we have done to date and sets a path toward the future. In Alberta, we have always been focused on taking action. If reducing human impact on the environment is the ultimate goal, then we want strategies that will actually promote change. That's why our updated strategy is one part visionary and one part pragmatic. It lays out how we will make a 200 megaton reduction over business as usual projections annually by 2050. In its broad strokes, it focuses on three areas: conserving and using energy efficiently, greening energy production, and implementing carbon capture and storage. I'll address the last two points in greater detail, but it's important not to lose sight of conservation and energy efficiency. It bears repeating. Reducing demand is absolutely essential to successfully addressing the challenge of climate change. The climate change issue belongs to everyone who drives a car, heats a home, shops at the local grocery store or department store. Nevertheless, while governments alone cannot reduce our energy demand, we do have a role. For example, our government committed to an incentive program to encourage consumers to purchase energy-efficient appliances and home improvements. We can also encourage similar behavior with industry, and in the case of Alberta, that means energy supply and production. So the question becomes, what does it mean to be a responsible energy producer? With all of the attention focused recently on oil sands, what you may not know is that we in Alberta have something else in common with you in the U.S. Our largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in Alberta is our coal-fired electric plants. So it makes sense that any actions we take need to apply to all industries. In Alberta, our greatest opportunity to truly reduce emissions and continue as a global energy producer will come from innovation and technology. By supporting innovation and advancing technology, we are increasing our potential to improve efficiency, to reduce or even stop emissions, and ultimately improve environmental performance. Alberta's regulatory system for reducing emissions is fundamentally designed to encourage innovation. We want to promote the development of new technologies and see them adopted in Alberta. Large industry is required to reduce emission intensity by 12% from an established baseline. We've been monitoring emissions in Alberta since 2003. Our legislation came into place in 2007. We now have 18 months under our belt with tremendous amount of experience. To reach compliance with this goal, companies have three options. They can make facility improvements to reduce emissions. They can purchase Alberta-based regulated offsets. We've done a tremendous amount of work in putting together robust protocols to determine whether offsets are real or imaginary. And we're more than pleased to share some of the successes and the odd failure that we've experienced along the way in determining what is truly a legitimate offset. Finally, they can pay $15 a ton, which goes into a dedicated technology fund. Let me expand on this technology fund for a moment because it's really a key to our strategy. Fund is not a means to generate revenue for the government. Far from it. All the money collected into the fund will go back to industry in support of projects that promote further emission reductions and energy efficiency. In our first half of year of operating the program, the fund collected about $40 million. The first half of the year was the last 6 months in 2007. The legislation has now been in place throughout 2008. Today, as we speak, March 31st is the final deadline that industry needs to provide us with their reconciliation. So I can't tell you exactly what the status is, because most of these reconciliation reports we receive from industry are accompanied by very large checks, and they tend to wait till the last minute to send them. But we expect after our first full year of operation, there will be about $100 million paid into this fund. And the fund provides the further benefit of leveraging investment by the private sector. In this, Alberta has a system that is unique in North America. Our regulations require mandatory emission reductions. We've put a price on carbon and created a regulated offset market in Alberta. We wanted to take action sooner rather than later, and I can tell you there has been a lot of learning as we go. We started by taking a step, which was mandatory reporting, and watched how industry responded. We learned from that response and took another step, mandatory reductions. Now we're watching and learning how industry responds to this phase before taking the next step. Is the system perfect? No, it's not. No system is. We think that we're getting closer. The more experience that we have, the better the system will work. Are we where we want to be when it comes to carbon pricing and who the system applies to? Again, clearly it's a work in progress. The answer is no. You need to start somewhere. The way I often frame it is that we put a 42-year plan in place when we announced our climate change strategy in 2008, and right now we're on year two. We've got a long ways to go, but we are moving forward. Our climate change plan is realistic about how Alberta will bend its emission growth line downwards and how long it will take. In the global game of clean energy technology, our actions to date have helped us to get on base. We're on base, first base. But we could hit a home run with carbon capture and storage, or CCS. The Alberta government has made one of the largest commitments to CCS in the world, $2 billion. Those are taxpayer dollars, not industry dollars. For a province of only 3.5 million people, to commit that kind of cash is significant, to say the least. And in fact, many experts agree that carbon capture and storage is the best way for Canada, including Alberta, to meet its emissions targets. This was just reinforced last week when the government of Alberta was recognized by the Aspen Institute, based in Colorado, for our commitment to reducing greenhouse gas emissions through carbon capture and storage. For Alberta in particular, carbon capture holds great promise because we have the ideal geology to make it work. Through this $2 billion investment, we expect to see 3 to 5 large-scale projects developed with the potential to permanently store up to 5 million tons of CO2 annually by 2015. This investment in CCS will pay long-term dividends for our province in many ways. I believe, as do my colleagues around the cabinet table, that Alberta is on track to become a center of global expertise and excellence when it comes to CCS. Alberta can be the model for how to reduce industry emissions. I'm confident that the door is open to a future where Alberta-made climate change technology solutions can be marketed around the world. There are tremendous opportunities for those with the knowledge and experience to apply CCS on a commercial scale. So it's no coincidence that at a time of fiscal uncertainty, and frankly, fiscal restraint, even in Alberta, our commitment to this funding remains crystal clear. It's a firm commitment on behalf of the government of Alberta. While there are many hurdles that lie between the reality of now and the possibilities of tomorrow, there's no denying that we are out of the blocks with this $2 billion commitment. Now, don't take my enthusiasm for CCS to mean that this technology is some kind of panacea. CCS alone will not solve the world's greenhouse gas emission issue. The reality is there is no silver bullet when it comes to reducing global greenhouse gas emissions. There will be no one single technology, no sweeping global changes to cut energy consumption dramatically overnight. Instead of a silver bullet, experts have suggested the concept of silver buckshot. And I think that's a good analogy. Put another way, we need to find a suite of solutions that can be applied to different circumstances in different ways. CCS is an important part in one of those solutions. It has the support of the United Nations and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And CCS projects are now being pursued in Norway, the UK, Denmark, and Australia. Most recently, the Obama administration has indicated it sees promise and potential in carbon sequestration right here in the U.S. So Alberta has a lot to offer in regards to CCS, not only to make real lasting emission reductions in our jurisdiction, but to take what we learn in the coming years and share this valuable knowledge with others. Well, 8 months ago, the speech probably would have ended right about here. After all, I've discussed the importance of CCS as a piece in the climate change puzzle, explained how it fits into our climate change strategy, touched upon some of the other actions we're taking that fall under our strategy, But as you all know, the world is a very different place today. And when we talk about technology investment, we have to do just that, invest. The economy has become an overriding priority around the world, and governments are facing the challenge of making strategic investments to get things moving. While Alberta is in an enviable position financially compared to some other jurisdictions, we're not immune to the global financial crisis. This means that our commitment to carbon capture and the private investment that it will leverage is all that much more valuable within and beyond our provincial borders. CCS will help ensure our economy continues to grow. It means more jobs, an expanded tax base, and ideally more energy revenue. You might say, why more energy revenue? Well, part of the reason is because CCS, a good portion of CCS is from enhanced oil recovery. You can inject CO2 into depleted oil reserves and re-engage some of the old conventional oil fields that have been all but abandoned due to low productivity. I'm told that in conventional oil, you only get about 15% of the resource out of the ground, any oil field, anywhere in the world. And through CCS injection, that can be increased to as much as 45%. So it has tremendous opportunities on that side of the equation as well. We'll also help to support our energy sector by encouraging investment in new value-added projects, striking that essential balance between sustainable development and environmental protection and preservation. So while I'm confident that we're on the right course, I'm often asked by Albertans why our government is going to all of this effort. Couldn't the billions of dollars be better spent on other priorities, they ask? After all, they point out that Alberta's share of global greenhouse gas emissions is much less than 1%. Albertans alone are not causing the earth to warm, nor are we alone going to stop it. But my response to these people usually comes in the form of a question back to them. I ask, what type of world do you want to leave for your children and your grandchildren? We all have a share of the responsibility, government, industry, and consumers. We're taking tremendous steps forward on climate change. We're setting achievable targets and laying out ways that we can get there. We're making unprecedented investments in technology. The world is looking for leadership on climate change. And the opportunity is there for the taking. And ladies and gentlemen, Alberta is taking that opportunity. Thank you very much. I think it might be easier if I stand for the question. So I think.
Okay, what I'll do then, I won't stand with you.
So okay. We'll move on.
We just have a couple ground rules we like to use for our questions here. One, identify yourself, and then two, if possible, make it a question. If you have a statement to make, that's fine too, but it's always good to have a question the minister can respond to. And I have a hand already there in the back. So.
Charles Duran. I'm associated here, but I'm actually at Johns Hopkins School of International Studies. I just came back from a week up there with 11 students, and we learned a tremendous amount. I'm wondering if you would tell us a bit about the government's plans to deal with the tailings ponds.
Well, there's really two areas to deal with tailings ponds. For those of you who don't, I'm sure you've all heard of tailings ponds, but you may not understand what they are and what the purpose they serve. The process that's used, and it's not unique to oil sands, it's the same in many mining operations, is that the product itself needs to be washed and cleaned in some form or other, and the vehicle that's used is water. So the tailings ponds are used to store the water that's used in the process. That water is then recycled. 80 to 90% of the water that's used is recycled water. But the state that the water comes out of the process is such that it can't be directly recycled. It has very fine particulate matter that is suspended in it, and so the tailing ponds are a process that's that allows that water to settle, the fine tailings to settle out, and then as the water begins to clear, they can pull water off the top of the pond and send it back into the process. The other purpose that the tailing ponds serve is to store that water, because there's a very rigid requirement on the part of our regulatory system that water, once it's been used as a processing agent, cannot be returned to the natural water system. So it's really twofold. It's to facilitate recycling and to prevent any contaminants that may have been accumulated during the processing from being returned into the system. What we're doing to reduce the impact of tailing ponds is a significant amount of research that's underway now to reduce the amount of water that's used in the process. That will have a significant impact. And in fact, there is far less water being used now of the magnitude of about 6 to 10 times than was just a few short years ago. And secondly, to speed up the rate at which these fine tailings settle out of the water. And so there's a number of very promising research initiatives underway that will speed that process up. Once that happens, you can recycle faster. Therefore, you don't need as large a tailing pond because you're able to recycle the water all that much faster, and you simply don't need as much water. So it's really twofold. By speeding up the rate that the water is usable for recycling, and also by changing the technology to reduce the amount of water that's needed in the processing in the first place. I do want to point out, though, that that the tailing ponds are associated with the mining operations. And I talked about the 175 billion barrels of oil that's available in the reserve. Most of that, 80 to 85% of that reserve, is not accessible through mining. The mining operation is only possible in a very limited part of the reserve where the oil deposits in the sand actually come close enough to the surface. In fact, in some cases, they break right through the surface. But like a coal mine or any other kind of pit mine, you remove the overburden, remove the soil that's on top of the resource, and then have access to it. Most of the resource is far too deep to make that anywhere practical. And so in those cases, we employ in situ, is the terminology that's used. So they basically drill down to the reservoir. There are a number of different techniques that are used. The most common right now is steam-assisted. So they inject steam into the reservoir. There's some very, very promising new pilot projects that are underway, some that are using solvent that is injected at room temperature, so you don't need heat, you don't need water. That's working extremely well, and when the solvent comes back up with the oil as you pump it back up, you can remove the solvent and recycle that. The other types of projects that are showing some progress is what's called heel-toe hot air injection, where they basically inject hot air under pressure into the formation, and that injects oxygen, and there actually ends up being combustion underground, and so you don't have to use any fuel, you don't have to use any water, you don't do anything. It actually is self-perpetuating, and then when you want to, you can control the amount of heat by the amount of air that you inject, and when you stop injecting air, the lack of oxygen then shuts the whole project down. There's a couple of pilot projects that are showing some tremendous progress in that area. So that, too, will have a huge impact on water consumption in the area.
My name is Joe Duker. I'm an independent energy analyst. But like Professor Duran, I have a non-resident association with CSIS. You mentioned achievable targets, but you mentioned only one date as a target, 2050. I wondered if there are targets for 2010, 2015, 2020, and so on.
I realized that this would require a little bit of blue sky, projecting the amount of output, the percentage from in situ versus surface mining and so on. But I'd be very interested in whether you have these targets or have considered them, because if you do in Washington, I strongly urge you to talk about them, because we have a lot of people in this town who are happy with a target of doing something by 2050, but kind of come up short when you ask them, what do you have to do by 2020 and 2030 to get there?
That's a really good question. We do have some interim targets, and the main one I talked about with our CCS $2 billion fund, it's 2 million tons annually by 2015. That's part of it. We also have said that we start to bend the CO2 emission curve downward in 2020, which means that there we anticipate continued growth, and so that through the implementation of the technology and the strategy that we have in place, we start to offset that growth and actually have a downward bend of the CO2 emission stream by 2020. The thing that I think is really critical when it comes to setting targets is that because our legislation is unique in North America, we're the only jurisdiction that actually has legislation in place, the compliance mechanisms that we have are relatively modest. 12% intensity reduction, $15 a ton, is a relatively modest amount. But it's nevertheless still generates $100 million in compliance fees over the first 18 months of operation. You can't get too far out ahead of everyone else when everyone else is talking aspirational targets but not actually implementing any kind of a regime for implementation. And there is no doubt in my mind that we can dramatically step up our targets if we are able to increase our compliance mechanisms, increase the intensity reduction that we have in our plan, but we can't do that unilaterally. We cannot step out so far ahead of our trading partners that we essentially create a situation where Alberta-based economy is not competitive with their counterparts throughout North America. That's why we are so interested and frankly optimistic about the comments made by President Obama about engaging in a North American discussion. And we're here, and the reason that I'm here meeting with a number of officials with the new administration is to find out how we can work with the new administration to develop this North America-wide regime so that Alberta can share the expertise that we have, can share some of the successes, and I mentioned some of the failures that we've had to date. But ultimately, we've got to see that price of carbon go dramatically higher than $15 if we're going to have success in implementing a lot of this new promising technology. And that is going to require not only Alberta and Canada, but it's going to have to require the U.S. and, frankly, beyond North American borders to make that work. I'm really pleased to hear that the Obama administration is serious about getting on with it, but also recognizing that they too are going to have to ensure that we don't get too far ahead of our trading partners, because it simply won't work if we create a situation where we're simply importing goods and not dealing with the problems at the point of where those goods are originating.
Hi, my name is Mei Zhang. I'm visiting from the University of Toronto for a week. And my question is, if the tar sand developments continue, many studies show that meeting the Kyoto targets will be unattainable for Canada. And I'm curious to know, by placing heavy emphasis on technology and innovation, I'm wondering if you're suggesting that Alberta and by extension Canada may be better off operating outside the UNFCCC process?
No, not at all. But I criticize the Kyoto targets by saying that they tend to be aspirational. Whether I'm right or not, I guess history will tell. But I think that it was irresponsible for Canada to sign on to the Kyoto targets without having a plan in place on to determine how they were going to achieve them. Alberta has a plan in place. Yes, it doesn't doesn't comply in its entirety with Kyoto. That's why we are engaging with our federal counterparts, with Minister Prentice in Canada, and Prime Minister Harper, along with the United States, in ensuring that the next generation of Kyoto, which will come out of Copenhagen this fall, not only sets targets, but also sets in place a plan, an achievable plan for achieving those targets. I think that, frankly, is what was missing. It certainly was missing from Canada's perspective, and I think that that it was virtually impossible for Canada to meet its Kyoto objectives without having the United States being a signatory to the agreement. It gets back to this whole issue of remaining competitive with our largest trading partner. We can't get so far out ahead of our largest trading partner that our ability to sell into an export market is compromised. And so I think that there are a number of things that need to be done. Technology is key, is an important one. But as I said in my presentation, it's not the only one. Everybody, consumers, governments, industry, have to accept more responsibility than what we have in the past. I would suggest to you that the average Canadian has done virtually nothing to help to achieve those Kyoto targets, even though there are lots of them that like to shake their finger at government. But I don't think that there are many households that have done a whole lot, change a few light bulbs, and that's about it. So we all need to get in this together.
Thank you. John Rickman with the Energy Daily. Just a question and a clarification. The clarification being, did I hear you say that Alberta's coal-fired power plants emit more emissions than the oil sands sector?
Yeah. Yes.
And the other was with a global climate change treaty expected in the next 2 to 3 years. How do you think that will affect the economics of oil sands production?
Well, it's dependent upon what the demand for oil is and what the price is. But you have to keep in mind that these projects are long-term in nature. I've lived in Alberta all my life, and the one thing that's one certainty we have in oil and gas driven economy is that there are peaks and there are valleys. We're in a valley right now, but there's no doubt in my mind that the price is going to fluctuate up and down many more times over the foreseeable future. And these projects, when they are put into place, take those kinds of fluctuations into account. The key really, though, is we need to develop these oil sands in a responsible way. And that, frankly, is going to drive up some of the costs. So it is even more dependent on what the long-term price projections are for oil. But oil has recovered quite dramatically in the last little while, and it's I would think that the existing operations, those that have been operating for some time now, are probably back into the black already, and much of the new investment is probably doing reasonably well at the prices that they are right now. What has caused people to sit back and think is, I think, more uncertainty on the regulatory regime, and B, on how long the difficulties will be experienced on capitalizing and finding investors for some of these very large mega projects.
Hi, my name is Patrick Brown, and I work for a government relations firm in Toronto that actually represents a lot of Canadian energy companies and trade associations. And I have two quick questions for you. You mentioned that there's going to be no silver bullet and that we should have a suite of solutions. And there's recently been a lot of attention to the role or potential role of nuclear energy in your province. So I'm curious if you could comment on that. And as well, you mentioned the $16 billion investment that is projected for the oil sands. And I'm familiar with Canadian, U.S., even foreign companies. I know Norwegian oil companies operate in the oil sands. Where do you look for, or what countries do you look towards for that kind of investment? And is there any country that perhaps you wouldn't welcome investment from? Every now and then there's talk about the Chinese investing in the oil sands. So your comments on those two points would be appreciated.
Well, let's deal with the investment side first. When we talk about this $16 billion investment, much of that is for completing projects that are already underway. The financing for those projects is already in place. And there are a number of them, a number of various companies that have made investments. Some Canadian, some are U.S. based, and there are a number that are European based. Difficult to determine exactly whether or not we're going to start to draw the line and say some investment is not welcome. I think the fact of the matter is that as long as people come and they follow our rules, follow our laws, respect the fact that that we are going to hold them up to the highest standards from an environmental perspective, and we won't be giving free passes to anyone based upon country of origin, be they Canadian, American, or otherwise. We're not, I don't think, going to be particularly perturbed where those investment dollars come from. On the nuclear issue, Alberta does not have a nuclear plant in place at this point, nor do we have any province-wide policy with respect to nuclear. Frankly, no one has ever asked us before, until now, if they could build one. Alberta has a number of unique qualities about it, but we tend to believe that there's a strong role for the private sector, and that applies to our electric power production as well. The government of Alberta does not have a crown corporation that owns hydro or electric generating capacity. Every generator that's located in the province of Alberta is owned by the private sector. We regulate. We have a high degree of regulation when it comes to power generation, but we do not own and operate. So right now we have an application, a company that has indicated that they're interested in building a nuclear facility in Alberta. We are just now beginning a public discussion with Albertans to find out what their views are. Certainly everybody is well aware of the pros and cons related to nuclear power. Alberta officially does not have a position. We recognize that this is something that is critically important to many people, and we hope to have a good public discussion over the spring and summer and come to some kind of a conclusion this fall, one way or the other. And our conclusion will be we will continue to be nuclear-free, or we will allow for the process to begin for the regulatory process to begin for the construction of a nuclear plant.
Since we're starting to run down on time, I think I'd take a couple of questions, two or three questions at the same time. That'll give you a chance to choose which one you want to answer. So we'll start here. Were there others? One in the back? Anybody on the right side here? Okay, we'll start with those two then.
I'm Nick Giuliano, I write for Carbon Control News. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, in the context of trying to create this North American climate policy, where a low-carbon fuel standard, such as has been discussed in California, and I think Henry Waxman has talked about introducing one in Congress, where that might fit into such policy, and if the insistence on that would be a deal-breaker for the oil sands industry. And also, if you could run down some of the officials you're meeting with this week on that subject.
Three questions. Just be one question. Bob Tatson with the Fertilizer Institute. Was wondering if you could comment a little bit, I believe, on what is called your processed gas exemption. I'd appreciate hearing more on that.
Okay. And is there one more?
I didn't see another.
Okay. I'll answer those. The the low fuel or low carbon fuel standard is something that I think we have no concern with, except, and it's pretty big except, that there needs to be a careful analysis on true life cycle, wells to wheels, as they call it, carbons that are included in the calculations. And so by that I mean if oil is going to originate in the Middle East and come over by tankers, and you don't account for all of the emissions that are accrued in the transportation of that product, you're skewing things inappropriately. Technology such as CCS is acknowledged appropriately, so that when you're making advancement of technology and that technology is being employed, that there isn't a penalty that would be applied to oil simply because they're using technology as opposed to having a lower carbon footprint at the outset. Finally, I think that it's important that it be a level playing field right from the very start. And so I'm not 100% conversant on where the discussions are going with respect to low carbon fuel standards, but I understand that there's a sort of an accepted blend that would form the basis, and I'd like to know how you get in on that club, because I'm not so sure that it would be fair to all the new players that want to come in. Who we're meeting with here, I don't have the names off the top of my head, but if you check with my communications people, our itinerary is public. The process exemption for fertilizer, good question. I talked about the fact that we've got large emitters of CO2 that are part of our emissions reduction program. For those of you who are not so chemically inclined like me, I have had to learn a lot in the last 2 years since becoming a Minister of the Environment. I say going into work every day is like going back to chemistry class in high school. When you produce fertilizer, nitrogen fertilizer in particular, there is, as part of the process, a pure stream of CO2 that comes off of that process. They don't have to do carbon capture. They've already got it. And there's nothing that they can do about it. When they produce fertilizer, you can't fine-tune the plant. You can't do anything. It is part of the process. And so when we have put together our regime for calculating the cost of CO2, or the amount of CO2 reductions that are required to come in compliance for a fertilizer plant and others like that have this pure stream of CO2 that is perfect and will probably become some of the first parts of the sequestration side of CCS, because we don't have to do the capture; it's already there. We have exempted those from the processing that are part of the processing. What we've not exempted is the amount of CO2 that is emitted through flue stacks and through the combustion of gas. But we have exempted that process gas. Now, begs the question: if we exempt it at the front end, should we include it on the back end? And I would suggest that once carbon has a value, and there is an opportunity to put that carbon somewhere, we'll have to have further discussions on how we deal with it and who gets the value for the credits that would accrue from storing that CO2. But to get things off to a reasonably fair start, that's what we have done on our regime in Alberta.
I was going to take the prerogative to ask you the last question, and it's pretty straightforward, I hope. You were talking about the $2 billion and the commitment to CCS projects and talking about 3 to 5 major projects coming forward. When do you see some announcements coming out about what types of projects will get awarded? I think this will be followed very closely because you really are a ways ahead of many other places.
We're shortlisting now. I have to be honest. It is the short list got a little shorter when companies had to go out and find funding for their matching portion. That's the reality of the market that we find ourselves in right now. Nevertheless, we're confident that we're going to have that 3 to 5 project list complete and the announcements made within the next 2 months. And so I'm hoping April, May, perhaps as late as June. So we're really excited about it. I also should mention, I didn't in my remarks, that when we made the announcement that the government of Alberta was going to support CCS with $2 billion of investment of public dollars, we made two announcements that day. One that I'm directly involved with, one that I'm indirectly involved with, and that was a commitment to a further $2 billion in public transportation and the reduction of tailpipe emissions through enhanced public transportation. And so that funding is also committed, and the rollout of that funding will begin in this current fiscal year. Our budget will be coming down on April the 7th. So I'll get back home just in time to face the budget. But there will be within that budget a fairly significant portion of that $2 billion commitment for this current fiscal year to go into public transportation. We'll also be rolling out in the very near future the details on our consumer incentive program for home insulating and energy efficient appliances, and then of course the quest continues in my office to convert the government fleet of operations to hybrid and low carbon fuel transportation. Started by leading by example. I have a hybrid car that I drive myself, and I've now got 3 other ministers that are driving hybrid cars. We've got about 20 in our Alberta Environment fleet, and every time there are vehicles that get replaced, we're seeing more and more of them come on. So we're making some progress in that area as well.
Well, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to come here and give us this excellent presentation. I think it's very helpful for the debate that's going on here. So, again, thank you. And join me.